May it please the court. My name is Mary Bullard. My bar number is 39382, and I represent Mr. Osman Guillen in this case. This case deals with a jurisdictional issue, which is based on the failure of what the state has termed a complaint to toll the period of the deferred judgment. The period of the deferred judgment in question and the probationary sentence were the same. They began with a guilty plea in May of 2004 and ended at the termination of those periods, in May of 2006. In between that time, in May of 2005, the Community Alternative Services, they filed what they termed a complaint for the revocation of the deferred judgment and the probation on the basis of the only basis that they gave was that Mr. Guillen was in the custody of ICE and had been and had an order for deportation, and therefore that one of the case supervisors believed that he had violated conditions of supervision. However, that complaint did not actually state what that violation was or when it might have occurred. Consequently, that was not sufficient to give notice and be a proper complaint that could toll the period of the deferred judgment. As a result, it is Mr. Guillen's position that his deferred judgment period continued to run until May of 2006, at which point it expired. And it's simply a matter of law that a complaint that does not give a defendant sufficient notice of an offense does not invoke the jurisdiction of the court.
To require notice, the fourth condition under the statute, 1611.205.2, says the filing of a report by the probation officer or a verified complaint by any person, together with an arrest warrant issued after a judge finds there is probable cause to believe a condition of probation has been violated. Here we've got the report signed by the probation officer in the form of a complaint and witnessed by the supervisor, and we've got a warrant.
Yes, but that report / complaint, which is what they termed it, a complaint, does not actually give any notice of what the violation was.
I'm terming it a report.
Okay.
It's a report, and obviously it's a complaint. The question is it a report? I'm not sure the report
has. So we're reading the statute as being more broad. If a report is written, then we don't have to give the defendant notice of what the violation was.
Well, as long as there's an arrest warrant, after the judge finds there's probable cause, I'm just reading the statute.
But the arrest warrant does not give notice of what the violation was. It does not accept. There isn't enough here even to support probable cause.
The question is, well, the problem you have is with that warrant. I guess it should have been quashed.
And the warrant on its face states that there is probable cause to believe that he's violated a condition, correct?
The warrant states that they believe that there's probable cause. However, the warrant is based on the report, and the report does not provide notice, and nor does the warrant provide notice on its face.
But the combination of those two documents, though, is what operates as the tolling, and then it's up to the defendant to come in and say, wait a minute, you know, that arrest warrant never should have issued, or I object, you know, the report's not complete. Or
so basically we can get around this whole giving notice and put the onus on the defendant simply because the community service officer, the probation officer, writes a report and
because the legislature wrote them into the statute.
I believe the legislature's intent was to ensure that both a probationary sentence and a deferred judgment give the defendant due process. That is how this court, several divisions of this court have interpreted that statutory language, is that due process requirements are entailed when a defendant is hailed into court on the basis that he has, you know, violated conditions of supervision for probation or deferred judgment. I would not say that you can get around that by simply saying that it's a report and a and a warrant. If we look at, for example, People v. Guerrero, that dealt with the fact that the probationary, the warrant didn't provide adequate notice to the defendant. And here, even read together, the report and the warrant did not provide Mr. Guillen with notice of what he had violated or when. So,
Ms. Wallard, considering that there's a jurisdictional argument made here, is it possible that the report and the warrant function basically as a placeholder, and that subsequently proper notice was conveyed, and ultimately your client admitted to one of those more specific things? So from a jurisdictional perspective, and I understand that to be your argument, if the place is held, isn't that enough for jurisdiction? And then for your client to be able to meet what the allegations are, your client knew specifically what the allegations are and ultimately agreed to one.
If we start with your first point, which is that that a complaint, that a report and a arrest warrant can be considered a placeholder, I would say that that is not what the statute envisions. The statute envisions that we give, in order to invoke the jurisdiction of the court, we must inform the accused of what he has been, what he is charged with. You can't just simply file a piece of paper and a piece of paper and simply say, well, that tolls a period, and then when we find him, we'll make additional findings. If that were the case, then you could, you know, file a placeholder and then 20 years later come back. And I think that the whole point of the deferred judgment statute and of the probationary statute was to make sure that we had a set period, that there was some finality, that the as the Colorado Supreme Court held that, you know, in the case of deferred judgments, the maximum time that they can run is 4 years. And so if we accept that simply some vague document that says, well, we believe he's violated some conditions, but they don't outline the conditions, I mean, that would mean that the courts would have jurisdiction essentially forever. And
well, isn't it sort of inherent? We believe that he has been taken into custody by ICE. Isn't that a suggestion that he's not satisfying any of the conditions?
Well, depending on what the conditions are, it's possible that he could, in fact, continue to commute those obligations. And there's no, you know, that you have to be specific. That is the point. There's no way for a person to defend against something that is nonspecific. And here, you can't say that simply a piece of paper that has no detail as to what the violation was or when it happened could ever serve to to invoke the jurisdiction of a court. I mean, if we look at all these other cases like McKitchens and Gore and Brunner, I mean, what we're dealing with is you must have a written notice of what the violation was such that a defendant can defend against them. And if you don't have that, then you simply haven't invoked the jurisdiction of the court. And therefore, the court has nothing to revoke. It has nothing. I mean, it ends by operation of law. I mean, if we look at things that have been found sufficient to toll jurisdiction, you look at things that talk about they outline in detail, you know, specific dates, what the violation was. If you look at Boykin, for example, you have a specific date that the defendant had struck his wife and stolen items. You have Holland, where, you know, the complaint adequately notified the defendant that he was charged with violating a specific numbered condition. And here, obviously, the original, what they term a complaint or report or whatever, was that all of that in combination was insufficient. Otherwise, the prosecution wouldn't have come back in March of 2010 to add in additional information. And if we look at McPherson, you know, basically there it held that the statutory conditions requirements were met when that motion identify the violation charged. And when the, you know, the condition of the probation alleged to have been violated was identified. And when, you know, the date and the location of the alleged violation, that's the bare minimum of due process that we require.
But the judge said here, in denying the motion, he said this being taken into custody by ICE means he can't comply with any of the normal terms and conditions of probation, so I think it's filed in good faith, and there's a violation. I would grant you there's probably a potential violation, but there's been nothing to indicate that he's been able to comply under the complaint.
But doesn't that shift the burden to the defendant then to establish that he didn't violate the conditions of probation?
Sure, it shifts the burden. I think the question is, does it give the court jurisdiction over this defendant? And once the court has jurisdiction, then the defendant has the full panoply of rights in defending himself, and the opportunity to dispute any allegation that he violated his probation.
I would agree that if the 2005 motion was sufficient, that we would have no problem here, because then, as you say, we would have jurisdiction. However, I do not believe that it is the policy of the legislature, as this court has interpreted it, or as the Colorado Supreme Court has interpreted it, to mean that simply anything can be filed, as long as you term it a complaint, as long as you term it a report, and that's sufficient to say, well, now we have jurisdiction on you forever and ever.
I quite agree. The court has to also find probable cause, just like the court did here. And I think that it was a fair inference on the court's part to say, look, he's in custody with ICE. He can't possibly comply with conditions of probation.
I believe that it was insufficient to support probable cause, because you did not say what those conditions were or when they were violated. And no written notice of that was given, which is required under Morrissey v. Brewer. I simply would hold that the warrant and the report or complaint, however you view it, I would say that was not sufficient to toll the period, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, GTSD, registration 36043, representing the people in this case. Case law is very clear that all that is needed to invoke the court's jurisdiction is initiation of the revocation proceedings. And this was done here, obviously, based on the complaint, including the report by the probation officer, indicating that the defendant had been taken into custody by ICE. And it is also worth noting that this was 6 months after the defendant had been detained, actually. So in May, he was detained, and the report indicated that that was the date. And then in October, 6 months later, the complaint was filed. So clearly within the 6 months period, defendant would not have been able to meet conditions of the probation or deferred judgment. And that is exactly why the court found probable cause, as Judge Graham pointed out. And that was sufficient to invoke the court's jurisdiction and toll the deferred judgment and probation period. There is no specific requirement there's no specific form either under the probation statute or the deferred judgment statute. And as long as there is enough information for the defendant to note that his deferred judgment or probation is in jeopardy, that is sufficient to support a probable cause finding by the court. And defendant has plenty of opportunity later on to request additional information or raise questions regarding the specificity of the information. Based on that,
pardon me, if I may ask you a hypothetical.
Yes,
let's assume that in this case, the document, and I know they didn't, but the document simply read, he's violated terms of probation, period. Or he's violated terms of the deferred judgment, period. Nothing else. Is that sufficient?
If it is a report under the statute, under the probation statute, the
it's those are the, all the words in the report.
According to
the probation officer files a report that says simply he's violated the terms and conditions of his deferred judgment, period. Nothing else. Is that enough?
Based on Galvin, case that addresses what is required, any of those four conditions stated in the statute would satisfy the initiation of the revocation proceedings. And one of them would be a report by a probation officer that some violation has occurred. So based on that particular provision, then it would be sufficient for the invocation of the court's jurisdiction.
So where does his due process right to be informed of the charges against him, and because there's no specificity there, where does his due process right kick in?
It is also clear, based on case law, that a defendant who is facing revocation of probation is not entitled to the full constitutional protection that a defendant who is being charged initially with a crime. So obviously, we are talking about different issues. And under case law, defendant is entitled to that much notification, which is included in the statute.
Counsel, does defendant also get notice of what is required of him by virtue of having a piece of paper that he signs that sets forth what the conditions of either his deferred judgment or his probation are?
Yes, Your Honor. Defendant has already been placed on notice that these are the conditions and any violation would subject him to revocation. So obviously he knows what the conditions are, and when there are complaints that those have been violated, so he knows what they are talking about. Unless the court has any question, we ask the court to defer judgment.
Thank you. Ms. Bullard, you have just under 3 minutes remaining.
I would simply draw the court's attention back to the probation statute. And I would hold that if we look at the language, that it requires that whatever notice is, whether it be a report and a warrant for an arrest or a complaint, that either must identify the violation charged and the condition of probation alleged to have been violated, including the date and approximate location thereof. I would read that language as applying to either or. That's 1611.205, section 5. So I think the statute, in its plain and bare wordings, simply requires that you have to tell the defendant in the complaint which notifies him that he is in fact in danger, in jeopardy, that at that point you have to explain why he's in jeopardy. You don't just tell him that he's in jeopardy. The state takes a position that simply that the initiation of revocation proceedings is simply the filing of anything, whereas in my mind the initiation of revocation proceedings is informing the defendant why he is they believe that he has violated.
Ms. Bullard, let me ask this kind of long winded question. When we're dealing with informants, for example, and the judge has to make a determination of probable cause, very often, if the informant is known by the police, the judge can make a finding of probable cause to issue a warrant. Here we've got a probation officer. The probation officer is the person charged with supervising this individual.
We have a supervisor of a supervisor.
And a supervisor. And the judge is told this person violated his probation. The only question for the court to determine at this point is not whether he did or not, whether there's probable cause to believe that he did.
But the issue is, what did he do? And I feel that is not, he's not informed of that.
Okay.
So that would be the position on that. But if we look at People v. Galvin, which the state cited in support, I would note that there the court had jurisdiction to revoke the defendant's probation. But what was filed there was a formal complaint. I mean, that contained all the information required for a complaint in support of probation revocation under 1611.205.5. And that was filed before the expiration of the defendant's probationary period. Here, we don't have that. We have a placeholder. And I don't believe that it is wise policy for this court to say that placeholders are a good idea, because that extends the district court's jurisdiction over limitless periods. And, you know, it would violate basically the intent of the legislature to have finality at the end of deferred judgment periods and at the end of probationary periods. And it would overburden the court if jurisdiction is retained forever, basically, simply by filing placeholder motions. And so, therefore, we respectfully ask that this court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you both for your fine arguments. This case is deemed submitted, and you may expect a written opinion in due course.